She comes from the United States. She's got a lot of tattoos and a great story. She's my kind of gal. Karen, here you go.
I'm Karen Nord. I'm an alcoholic. I actually only have one tattoo. It's just a very large tattoo. So I'm not the kind of person to get a lot of tattoos. You know, just the one. Just have the one. But what can I say? You guys are incredible. Thank you again. I'm not going to thank anybody in particular because I know. I've worked in enough AA events that I know I don't know everyone involved. And many of the people who've done the most work here, I'll never know. And that's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing, you know, that we come, we do this work, we go, the results are what they are, you know. And I can tell you, I have never felt this well taken care of. And that's a nice thing. And I can't believe you're all here this morning. I am so surprised. I thought Earl and Doug just had you guys laid out, you know. I was sure that I would be speaking to the really hard cases left this morning. And apparently that's all of you, you know. Which is great. Don't ever change. Stay this excited. Stay this crazy about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the way to be. I was lucky enough to get sober in a community that was excited about AA and excited about being sober and carrying this message and doing this work and living this life, and we were just wired, and so this feels. This really brings me back, and I'm lucky enough to live in a community like that today. But occasionally someone during this last 15 years has come up to me and said, you should settle down. You know, you should, you know, take it back a couple notches. Take it a little easier. Leave something for somebody else to do. You know, you don't have to try to, you don't have to work this hard at it. And I've occasionally kind of listened to that, and the results have never been good. I drank every day. I went after alcohol and drugs as a full-time job, and I think I need to approach my sober life the same way. You know, I didn't get sober to go watch television shows. You know, I got sober so I could live the life so I could live a life. And anyway, so don't ever change, and thanks. I was out this morning. I went for a run this morning through Reykjavik, and went for a run, and I do that for a few reasons. One, so I can say things like I went for a run this morning through Reykjavik. Which is, it's got a nice ring to it, and it, you know, it proves to you all that I'm taking care of myself and. And two, so I can take care of myself because I do want to be sober and live a healthy life for a long, long time, as long as possible. And three, because I've just, even at the end of a weekend like this, I've got way too much energy and I've got to find a place to, you know, I have to find a way to deal with it. And four, because it seems to be one of the few times when I can, it's got there's a meditative quality to that kind of activity for me. So I do it for that. But this morning I'm running through Reykjavik, and when you run in the States, people don't pay much attention to you because it's common, you know. If they do, you know, occasionally someone will see to make sure, you know, you're not running from something in case they should start running too. So, you know, that will occasionally happen. But other than that, it's kind of, or they may look and see if your running style is as advanced as their running style. But that's about it. Here, you know, I had every taxi that went by me stopped to see if I was, you know, in need of something, a ride or... And several people just kind of stopped and looked at me to make sure I wasn't in any kind of trouble. It was very nice, you know. I was like, I'm just running. You guys are great, friendly, wonderful people. I've had just a wonderful time here. But I was running down, I ran down the shopping street, and then I turned around and ran up the harbor. And about halfway up, we got here Thursday morning. We left Wednesday night. And about halfway up the harbor, my brain showed up. And I hadn't realized that it was still someplace over the North Atlantic. Apparently, I've been working with only part of my mind for the last few days. So it finally showed up, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm all here now. I'm all in Iceland. So I have no idea what this is going to be like at all. But I'm all here. I'm here this morning to tell you about my experience, strength, and hope, and hopefully what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. And I'll tell you right away that I am not going to make you laugh as hard or think as much as Doug did. And I'm not going to inspire and ignite you as much as Earl did. I don't have that yet. I want what Earl has, you know. I want what Doug has. But I'll offer you what I have. And we'll see how it goes together. I am also one of those people who doesn't really like it up here. I don't, you know, I think I come across as an incredibly social person. You know, hey, how are you? You know, and, you know, everything's, yeah, you know, and that's what I do professionally, and I've pulled that off pretty well, but it's not me. I'm in the basement. You know, I'm watching Gilligan's Island. I'm, you know, I'm writing poetry. Not good poetry, but, you know, poetry. I'm scared. I'm lonely. I don't know what to say. I don't talk well to people. And I'm not that, you know, I'm not that social of a person. So coming up here isn't that easy for me. But it does seem to work for me. And I do think it's our responsibility. What is that? Maybe it's just me. I don't know. We'll just pretend. I'll never mind. Pretend I didn't say that. Okay. Anyway, I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I spent most of the first 20 years of my life there. I was a troubled kid in an untroubled home. I was a troubled kid with no troubles, which is very troubling. It's really hard to pull off. There was no, you know, my family is, if you wanted to like point to a functional family, there, that's the Nords, my family. They are, you know, my dad is an architect. He's retired now, and he got up every day at, you know, 7 o'clock and got dressed, had breakfast, kissed my mother goodbye, and backed out of the driveway and went to the office. And, you know, we didn't hear a word from him until 5:30, when he would call my mother and tell her he was on his way home. And he would then leave the office, come home, get in the door at 5 to 6, and we would sit down and have a lovely dinner. And then my dad would go off and do whatever dads do. In functional homes, and I had two brothers, and my brothers and I would come down the stairs every morning about 7:45, and my mom would have three bowls of cereal, three glasses of orange juice, and three piles of vitamins lined up for us. And we would eat our cereal, and she would give us our lunch, and we would march off to school. And you know, we'd come home, and we'd do our homework. And if we were good, we'd get to watch a little Batman. And that was it, you know. Not a lot of trouble. Very dull. Nobody ever took a swing at anybody. Nobody ever yelled at anybody. You know, everybody loved each other. How are you supposed to work with something like that? You know, what's... And I knew by the time I was, you know, 9 or 10 years old that this was not right. And about that time, I met the first person who was to become, you know, one of the bigger influences on my early life and a real good friend. And her name was Terry. She was a girl that lived a couple blocks away. And Terry came from a much different home than I. Her parents were divorced, which wasn't typical in suburban Minneapolis at that time. It was, you know, we were a little upscale. And that wasn't considered to be a part of that lifestyle at all. I mean, there probably were plenty of couples who should have been divorced, but they weren't. And so Terry's parents were divorced, and her father was an alcoholic. And he used to roar into town every 3 weeks or so, drive up on the lawn or, you know, drive into the house or whatever, you know, drive any place but the driveway, drive into something and run in the house and throw people around and take all the money and, you know, and smack Terry's mom around a little bit, and then he'd leave and everyone would just kind of go, whew, you know, that was bad. That wasn't as bad as last time, or, you know, something like that. And then Terry's mom was also an alcoholic, and she liked country and western music, which also wasn't common in my neck of the woods. And she had the big hair, and she wore the, you know, the kind of the Dolly Parton-esque type outfits. And she used to date these guys that were like, you know, like truckers and stuff, you know, which also wasn't particularly common. But it was like they took a little piece of, I don't want to disparage any part, a little piece of a much different part of the country than what I grew up in, and clunked it right into the middle of Minnesota. So, anyway, she would go out on dates, and she drank tequila, and, you know, she smoked like 4 cigarettes at a time, and she never cooked anything. I mean, I never even saw food in their house, literally. And Terry's older brother was a drug dealer, and a very good one. And her younger brothers were, I was 11 at this time, and her younger brothers were 8 and 9. And I don't even think they had shoes. I don't even think they went to school. I don't ever remember them going to school. You know, and they were just always, they were like these wild, you know, savage little Indians running around the house, you know, and rather dangerous. And there were always like clothes strewn around the house, and you kind of worked your way around the piles, and, you know, anything went at Terry's house. And I just loved it there. I thought, now this is a family. This is, there's a lot going on here. You're never at a loss for something to do. And it was true. So Terry and I became friends. And I had my first drink at that house, and I hadn't planned on, you know, a life of alcoholism. I knew what alcoholism was. I actually, despite my functional family, maybe this was one of the reasons for my highly structured home life. But both my father's parents were alcoholics, and I knew, I had seen them in action, and I knew what it was like. And alcohol, and, you know, it was ugly, and it was not what I wanted. It was not what I expected at all. I expected to grow up to be somebody famous, you know. I thought I'd be an artist or a famous zoologist or an archaeologist or some kind of ologist, you know, something really like, you know, exciting, where you're like in Egypt and you discover the lost tomb of King Tut's father, you know, and it turns out to be even better than King Tut's tomb. And everybody's like, that Tut, that was nothing. You should see this. You know, something like that. I thought I would be something. I had no idea what, and I had no plan for getting there. You know, I just one day I would graduate from high school and I would become a famous archaeologist, you know, or something like that. Just like that. And I had no plan, but you know, I mean, and that's, I think, is central to, the reason I mention that is I never had a plan. I never had a plan. For some reason, I never had any hopes or dreams or anything. But I knew what alcoholism was, and I sure didn't plan on becoming an alcoholic. So I started, but I seemed to be attracted to the darker side of life. When I went to San Francisco to visit my grandparents, I wanted to go to Haight-Ashbury and see the hippies every time. Horseback riding? No, hippies. We'll see the hippies. Maybe we'll try to work in some horseback riding on the last day. Topless bar. Let's go to a topless bar. And, you know, that's I just always was like that. So anyway, here I am, 11 years old. I was considered at that time to be a fairly bright kid. It's not a mistake many people make today, but I was, and I did good in school. I was a good kid in a lot of ways. And as such, I ended up in junior high school a year ahead of most of the kids I knew. I was 11. Everyone else pretty much was 12. And I was not a well-put-together 11 by any stretch. You know, I was as tall as I am now. 5'9". I weighed about 100 pounds. I was like this big around. I rattled when I walked. You know, awkward was invented. The phrase the awkward stage was invented for me. I had blonde hair that just kind of flew everywhere. It never would do anything. I wore glasses. I was awkward, and I was like intensely aware of how. Of how much this wasn't coming together for me, you know? And it was bad. So that was, and heretofore, up to this point, this was the most difficult situation I had ever found myself in, which isn't saying much for somebody who's like, yeah, I want to get out there, you know, I want to get on the wild side. They throw me in a big junior high school, and I fall completely to pieces. You know, and you know, I think that's what happened. Like many people, I just ran out of coping skills. I wasn't getting by in the neighborhood. You know, I was having trouble with flashlight tag. I was confused and upset by picking sides for a neighborhood baseball game. That was too much for me. You know, that was a retreat to the basement. And let's turn on Gilligan's Island and try to, you know, block it all out. There are no other people. There are no kids. It's fine. It's fine if you don't have friends. It's fine if you don't get along. So, you know, this was a big deal for me. And I got to this large junior high school, and the first couple of weeks were just terrible. And then, you know, much like Earl just had described last night, someone, for some reason, no reason I can identify, came up to me, other than maybe it was like a bet. Maybe this was like a bet. Came up to me and said, do you want to go smoke a joint? And this was an extremely unawkward 12-year-old girl. She had it going on. Even at 12, you just knew this girl was never going to be at a loss for anything. And she was everything that I wanted to be. And I said, yeah, sure. And I knew what pot was. Like I said, Haight-Ashbury. And, you know, this was 1971, probably. So, Yeah, and so we did, and, you know, nothing, I would love to say that something happened there. Nothing really happened, except for that I had a social interaction that was above and beyond anything that was going on in my life at that time. This girl seemed to genuinely be interested in me, and she became a friend, you know. And between her and my other friend, I felt like I had really arrived socially. You know, I was hanging out with the big dogs, you know. And I started smoking pot. No good reason. No moral dilemma either, for sure. I never thought, gee, you know, at 11 years old, is it a good idea for me to begin down this path? Is this wise? Will I pay for this in some way later in life? Is this damaging to me psychologically, physically, or emotionally in any way? No, none of that stuff entered into my thinking at all. And so I started smoking pot, and then I started using pills, and my life changed quite a bit. However, what changed for me was my circumstances. They got much better. You know, I was hanging with a better class of people. I was slightly more comfortable. The alcohol and the pills were taking the edge off, so I wasn't so edgy all the time. And I felt like I had arrived. I still wasn't drinking at this point. I took my first drink when I was somewhere, 12 and a half, 13, probably 13. And it was at Terry's house. Lots of alcohol, many choices there about for alcohol. We picked tequila. We were both big fans of the show Hawaii Five-0. They drank a lot of tequila on that show. You know, every time you saw somebody sitting in the bar, they were like, they had the shot glass and the lime and the salt. And, you know, it was like, God, that looks a lot better than just regular drinking. That's kind of glamorous, you know. So we thought, we're 13. It's time we learned how to drink. You know, I mean, time's a-wasting. Gotta get this down eventually. So Terry and I both decided we were gonna try drinking, and she had as many good reasons not to want to drink as I did, and we sat down and we got the lime and the salt and the little cups and, you know, did the tequila, and by the third shot, I knew that I would never be the same. It was an amazing experience, as I'm sure you have picked up on already, as subtle as I've been about it. I was not a person very well connected to people or to life. You know, I felt really closed off. I felt like there was a wall between me and the world. I couldn't connect with your experience. I couldn't connect with your life. I didn't understand how you felt about things. I didn't understand when people talked about religion, why they would get that kind of slightly misty look. I didn't know why people gazed at the stars at night and said, who then made all this? You know, I didn't know any of that stuff. The deepest thought I ever had outside of schoolwork was, why do they always give the stuff to get off the island to Gilligan? You know, he's never going to do it. That was as deep as it got. And after the third shot of tequila, I knew that I was a part of the world. You know, I could feel it turning. I felt connected to the people around me and to the planet as a whole. And I knew what they were talking about in church. It all just came together for me, and I felt whole. And that was it. You know, I didn't know it was missing until it happened. I would have never, even if I had been able to articulate it, ever said to you, I feel like something is missing from my life. I just thought I was born in the wrong place, the wrong time, the wrong family, and that was the deal. And that maybe everybody felt this way. And then that I started to drink, and it all changed. And I drank a lot. I made a commitment to alcohol as a lifestyle, and I never really looked back. You know, I didn't look back for years and years and years and years. I was in my first treatment center when I was 15. I was in my last one when I was 29. And I was in a lot of them in between. That was my life. Other people had high school athletic careers, or they were cheerleaders, or they went to college, or they planned families, or they, you know, got jobs, or whatever. I was institutionalized. You know, that was my lifestyle. And in my first treatment, I met my first members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew immediately that I knew when I was 15 that I was an alcoholic. This gentleman stood up at the podium in this treatment center and told his story. He was 45 years old. He had nothing in common with me, and I identified with everything that he said. And I thought, shit. And that was pretty much what these were the prevailing attitudes of the next 16 years of my life, or 15 years of my life. Why did it have to be me? You know, I mean, there was this whole family of people to choose from. Why me? You know, don't I have enough trouble already? Isn't it hard enough being me without throwing this into the mix, you know? So that was one. I never lost that. I was always pissed off because I was the one. The other prevailing thought was, I'm too young. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm young. You know, I haven't had a DUI. Of course, I don't have I don't know how to drive yet, so that's... I haven't had a DUI. Not that that stands in everybody's way, but I haven't had a DUI. I haven't been to prison. I haven't beaten anybody up. I haven't lost a job. I haven't done any permanent physical damage to myself. I am 15 years old. I have probably caught this just in time. Thank goodness. I'm going to try to control my drinking in the hope that, you know, we can somehow or another change this equation. So I left that treatment center, and I went back to high school, and I tried, and it didn't work. And the next time was a little bit worse, and the next consequences were a little bit worse, and on it went. And I tried everything. I'm going to kind of breeze through this because it's boring. And I tried everything. You know, I had that list. I had a long list. And I think a lot of people who find out about this young, they have a list like that too. I had a long list of things that hadn't happened and a long list of things I hadn't tried. And I tried them all. I tried money. I tried no money first, because that seemed like a kind of a good idea. I thought to myself, here's the thing. I need to hit bottom. If I hit bottom, I will rise up from that bottom like a phoenix from the ashes, and I'll say, phew, close call, not going to do that anymore. Thank goodness that this happened when I was young and I caught it in time. So I thought, how better to hit bottom than to find somebody, you know, then let's go look for it. So I found a guy who was a couple years, I was 16 at the time. I was out of school again because, you know, I have power now. I don't need school. I have power. If I can figure out a way to use it, to harness it effectively, I got the power. Now I just have to, so I don't need school. I'm back out of school. Find this guy, a couple years older than me. He's a biker. He's a drug dealer. He's a violent, dangerous person already at 18. And I thought, here's the ticket to the bottom. This is going to work for sure. If anybody's going to the bottom, it's this dude. You know, he's on his way. He's got his ticket stamped already. So I moved in with him, and I searched. I mean, he found the bottom. I found what was under the bottom. You know, he took it as far as he wanted to go, and I took it further. And a year and a half or so later, he threw me out the bay window of his house, and I thought, this is not working. This is clearly not, this is not going to work for me anymore. And so I picked myself up and went to a friend's house, one of those codependent people who will always take you in. And she did. And she cleaned me up. And I went downtown, and I thought, you know, that didn't work. Let's try the other direction. So I went, I said, living in the dirt, living in the gutter doesn't work. Let's see what happens if I try to live the good life. You know, maybe what I need, maybe what I've really wanted is to have a shot, to try to put, you know, to try to be everything that I know I could be. So I went downtown. You know, Patsy cleaned me up. She borrowed me some clothes. I went downtown and got a job in a stock brokerage. If 3 days earlier, I'd been flying through a bay window. You know, now I'm downtown, a job in a stock brokerage. Know exactly what to do. Get the job. They think I'm wonderful. And I start working there. And before I know it, I am the youngest registered stockbroker in the state of Minnesota. And I am just cooking, you know, 6 months, and I'm just cooking. And this guy has given me his B book. You know, I'm calling all these big accounts, and they're like, everybody's saying, you know, you're going places, kid. And I thought, yeah, this is it. This is it. I'm still drinking. I've picked up a little heroin problem on the side, which just is more of a regulator than anything else, because you know, it just helped kind of get me through the cold calls, you know, because they made me nervous. And I all of a sudden my boss cut me loose. He said, "Fly, be free. You know, you're no longer working with me. You're ready to go out on your own." Which is any other person to him that seemed like a great thing. And by all looks on the outside, I was completely ready for it. I fell apart in a week. I couldn't handle it. And I don't know if it was because I just was too young and I was afraid, or if it was that I just reached the end of that particular rope. 6 months of controlled behavior is a lot for an alcoholic of my type, so it might have been that. So that didn't work. And I thought, you know, those people weren't good for me anyway. They were all about the money. Money, money, money. That's not me. I'm not materialistic like that. And I said, you know what I need is I need to get out of the city. I need to live in the country. I need to find a relationship that's meaningful. And all of a sudden, he showed up. This guy just waltzed into my life. He lives in the country. He's wealthy, which I find meaningful. You know, I think that's got a lot of meaning for me. And, you know, his family's lovely. They're lovely, lovely people. They were like the Waltons. You know, they were just, "Hi, Karen, come on in. I'm just fixing breakfast. Go take a bath. We love you," you know. And they just loved me. They had chickens. You know, what else do you want? It was perfect. So we were in love, and I moved up north, and as it happened, you know, odd, strange, who knew, Greg turned out to be an alcoholic. And, no one was more surprised than I. And He was a bad drunk. He was a bad drunk. And I mean, he made me look good, which turned out to be not such a bad thing, for at least for a while. So anyway, here we are. We're married now, and I'm starting to realize, you know, this guy's got some problems. He's violent. He's unpredictable. He's got way too many female friends. He has no responsibilities, and because he's wealthy, he did work though, I must say, which I mistakenly thought for a while was due to some moral fiber that he had, some, you know, work ethic. But, you know, he was a demolitions engineer. So, and finally I realized he just liked blowing things up. He didn't have to work. He was dedicated to the art of demolition in every area of his life. And as it turned out, things got a little hot for us in Minnesota, and we started to move. So we found the perfect gig for a couple alcoholics. He got a job with a company that did reconstruction, and he was the demolitions expert. Had a whole crew of people who were just as crazy as he was. I mean, it was like traveling with the carnival. You know, they were like carnies with explosives. So, and we just travel from city to city, about 6 months per city, which is working for us right now. You know, 6 months is about as long as I can go without completely destroying everything in my life. And so we never have to, I mean, we're like, we come into town, we set up, Greg blows up a few things, you know, we make some friends, he blows all of them up, and we say, you know, gotta go, we've got other stuff to blow up over here, and we'd love to stick around and help you clean up, but gotta go. We're working. So that's what we did. We did that for a few years, and things got, for me, worse and worse and worse. And every so often, somebody would pick me up and pour me into a treatment center, and I would have the discussion that became a customary part of my life. And it was something like this. You know, things are really bad for me right now. I know. And I've been down this road before. I know. I know I'm an alcoholic, and I know I've tried this a million times. I've tried. I don't want to live this way. But I really, and I know it doesn't seem like I've appreciated all the help I've gotten before, but I just want you to know that I feel like in this place with you and these people, I can make this work. I really feel, I feel it this time. And it was crap. I didn't believe a word of it. And I wanted to. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I wanted to. I wanted to believe that. I wanted to be able to sincerely say, I think you can help me. But I didn't believe it. I knew they couldn't. By the time I was 24 years old, I'd been in treatment 10 times. I knew I couldn't have an authentic experience. I felt so programmed in that, and I had screwed up so many times, and I had blown so many chances, and all I could do was just keep kind of going through the motions. And it never occurred to me to be honest and to say, you know, I have no idea what you guys are talking about. I don't have a clue. I don't get this at all. I am scared. I'm lonely. I'm going to die. I know that. I can't be honest with you. I won't even know where to start. I don't even know what that means. And, you know, I couldn't say that. I wouldn't have known to say it. I was that far removed from, And I know you guys all know what I'm talking about. So that's where I was at. Anyway, in 1987, I came back to Minneapolis, and I was 28 years old, 27 years old, and I left my husband finally. There was just one beating too many, one problem too many, one too many, you know, finally, amazingly. And I moved into this big house that was owned by his family, and I kind of set up shop there. And I knew I was going to die at this time. I had done 12 treatments, and nothing had worked. I had tried everything. And I knew it was over, and that it was just a matter of time. And what I wanted at that time was to just cash it in as quietly as possible, and to try not to do anything else. So I sat down. I sat down and I drank, and I drank for about 18 months, and I didn't go much of anywhere, and I didn't talk to anybody, and I didn't do anything because I was so terrified of myself by that time and what I was capable of. So I boarded up most of the house, and you know, every couple weeks I'd board up a little more. It was a nice place when I moved in. It wasn't so nice when I moved out. And I lived in the living room and on the front porch, and I had a little dog named Waldo, who I owed a great deal of amends to after I got sober. And Waldo, I got to tell you this. This always makes me laugh. Waldo was, which goes to show you, even in the darkest times, there's something funny, you know, about us. Waldo was a great little dog. He was a schnauzer, and he was just, he was so cute, and he loved me so much, and God knows why I should have, you know, I mean, he should have left me years ago. And Waldo was my only companion at this time. And I would sit and drink, and then I would pass out, and I'd get up, and I'd drink, and I'd pass out. And every so often, I would go visit a guy that I knew that was a heroin dealer, and I would take myself away from the drinking a little bit with heroin. And then every so often, I would go visit another friend of mine who was a crack dealer, and I would take myself away from that by smoking crack. And then I would go back, and I would do the whole thing again. And I knew it was just a matter of time. I mean, I was nuts. I was just nuts. And I was back down to my seventh grade weight of 100 pounds and, you know, looking mighty fine by this time. And, you know, I knew it was soon, any time. And Waldo, one day, was standing at the window. I came out of, you know, some kind of a fog or another, and my dog was standing at the window on this little table. And he's wagging his tail, and he's barking out the window, and these people are going by and saying, "Waldo! Waldo! Hey, Waldo!" And they're talking to him, and Waldo's barking, and he's all excited. And I'm like, who are these people? How do you know these people, Waldo? You know, I have no idea who they are. I don't know anyone in my neighborhood. Waldo has managed to bond with the neighbors. He's got a life going on. For all I know, he's at dinner parties. You know, he's out, you know, playing cards with these folks. Obviously, he's got, and I thought, my dog has a better social, is more socially adjusted than I am. My dog has managed to put something together. And I can't. It was a low point, let me tell you. Anyway, shortly after, somewhere around Thanksgiving of 1988, I got this idea that just seemed to come to me out of nowhere, like many ideas have always done. And I thought, I think somebody called me and said they'd seen my family at Thanksgiving. And I thought, you know, I'd like to see my family. It's been a long time. Now, they only lived, you know, a mile or so away, most of them. I hadn't seen them in a long time. You know, my folks had asked me to take a step out of their life a number of years before that, which is a good thing. That was the right thing for them to do at that time. And I knew they loved me. It wasn't that. So I thought, I'd like to see my family. I'm going to die. You know, I think I should try to see them before I die. So I'm going to go see them at Christmas. And that's 3 weeks away. I'm going to have to kick one of these habits at least, if not a couple. I made a plan. I had detoxed myself many times, you know. Not from everything, but from at least a couple of things. So I thought, all right, I'll kick the crack, then I'll kick the heroin, and then I'll stop drinking a couple of days before Christmas so I can go over there and I won't be drunk. And I kicked the crack, kicked the heroin, got to the alcohol. It's a few days, December 14th, 1988. And I decided to start tapering off. I was trying to taper off. So I drank just a little bit, or a little bit for us. Probably quite a lot for somebody else, but a little bit for us. And I was tapering off, and I started to, a day and a half or so went by, and I started to get the sense that this wasn't going particularly well. Funny things were happening. I was having seizures. Unusual even for me. You know, it certainly wasn't my first experience, but, you know, they were coming. It was like one big seizure, you know. I was seeing things, which shouldn't have surprised me at all if I'd had any, I mean, if I knew as much about alcoholism as I claimed to. It was bad. It was bad. And it was so bad that I nearly called somebody. If you can imagine. I mean, crazy thinking like that started to happen to me. And about a day later, and now I know I'm going to die, you know. I mean, it's clear. And the timing is not quite what I expected, but it's definitely going to happen. And about a day later, my younger brother came over. No reason. He still doesn't know. We've talked about it a million times. Shows up at my door, and he comes in, and there I am. And he picks me up and throws me over his shoulder, grabs my other brother. They drive me out to his place, and got someone to help me. I didn't know any of this. You know, I wasn't around for this part. So Jay would have to be here to tell you this. I woke up, and I was on their couch, and Jay and his wife came to talk to me, and they said, we will take you somewhere. We're only going to ask once, and we'll take care of everything. And if you don't want to go, you can just get on your feet and go, you know, go away, and we won't bother you again. Because Jay was just doing what he felt like he had to do, you know. He couldn't watch me die in front of him, so. And I was so angry. I was angry. First of all, I was like, how dare you help me? How dare you care this much? How dare you be standing there on your feet, being able to make this offer to me? How dare you not be the alcoholic? And I was so mad. I was about to tell him all of this when his wife said, and she doesn't remember saying this either. I mean, I don't know if she really did. But it was the kind of thing she would say. She said, just go. You know, what do you have to lose? You know, maybe somebody can help you if you're like this. And I thought, all of a sudden, I mean, all of a sudden I realized what they were seeing and how different it was from what I was experiencing. I saw my life from Jay and Gretchen's perspective. I saw how stubborn I was, how much obstinance there was in my attitude towards this, how little I was interested in learning anything about anything, how afraid I was, how risk adverse I was, how much of this was my own doing. The alcoholism I was born with. You know, so much of it since then has been my unwillingness to be able to accept this as an outcome. This cannot be. This cannot be. And I saw it just for a second, and I said, okay, I'll go. And I went. And I went to another treatment center. I had very little hope. I knew people got sober. I knew people got sober. I didn't think it was all. I thought you guys were pretty kind of, you know. I mean, I felt kind of sorry for you. It seemed a little starry-eyed to me. But I knew people got sober, you know. But I didn't think I could get sober. So I went to the treatment center, not much hope, but again, you know, why not? I've looked death in the face, why not one last time? So I went and I met a counselor who happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think that's a big just happened to be, I think that was central in all of this. And I owe that woman a lot. She was about 18. She looked like a candy striper. They don't have candy. She looked like a student nurse. She looked like a cheerleader. She was like, sobriety, sobriety, go, go, go. You know, I mean, it was that kind of, give me an S, give me an O. And she was just, and I thought, oh, my God. I mean, I came here and they're going to, I mean, I have, this is what they're doing to me? Where's the crusty old, so you're here to get sober. Well, drop and give me 20. You know, where's that person? Where's the one that I'm going to be able to, you know, just completely confuse with my psychological profile? You know, where are those people? I get this woman that is just imperviously happy about being sober. So, and we sat down. And I went into my speech, you know, because I didn't have any other lines. I have no other lines in this situation. I knew it wasn't going to work. And I went into my speech, you know, I know I've tried this many times. I've failed. I haven't been able to do this, and I've been given so many opportunities. But I really feel in this place with you people and working with you is somehow I'm going to be, you know, and she's like, yeah, you know. And I gave her all this information, told her all about my problems, you know. I'm angry, big surprise there. I have low self-esteem, another shocker, you know. I'm financially bankrupt, no, you know, that's unusual for us. I have trouble with relationships. You know, it was startlingly surprising to her. She was not at all impressed by this. And she said, she smiled and she nodded. And she was like, okay, that's nice, yeah. And then she wrote down all this stuff, and then she took the whole file very dramatically, I think, because she wanted me to get the point, and I'm not that bright about these kinds of things, threw it in the trash. She said, we're not going to work on any of that stuff. And I thought, oh, we're way off script here. You know, I have no idea what's going on. And she says, we're not going to work on any of that stuff. And I thought, God, maybe she's not even a counselor. You know, she may have. I mean, I'm kind of excited because, you know, it's new, and I'm kind of scared because it's like maybe she's not a counselor. Maybe she just snuck in here. Maybe she's like an escaped mental patient. She's going to pull out this big knife and say, because you're dying right now, you know, and like stab me. I mean, I have no idea. It's just, so I'm like, okay. And she said, She said something that was even more frightening than that. She said, I want you to go out in the woods. It's this beautiful treatment center out in the rural Minnesota. I want you to go out in the woods and sit down on a bench, conveniently placed bench, and write down in 25 words or less your concept of a higher power. And I just thought, God, she almost had me there for a minute, you know. This is pathetic. This is beyond lame. You know, do you have any idea who you're dealing with? Do you know where I've been? 25 words or less, a concept of a higher power that can solve my problem? I am hopeless. I have done everything wrong, not just when it comes to alcohol and drugs, every place. I have done everything wrong in my life. And this is your solution. This is the great solution. This is what you offer me. This is it. But I didn't say that, of course. I said, interesting. And I did it because I knew it wouldn't work. I mean, I knew it wouldn't work. But I thought, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, crush her with my mighty intellect on this point at some point. She's going to be disappointed, but she's very excited right now. She seems really happy. You could tell that she thought this was a great idea. I didn't want to disappoint her. Give her a few minutes to kind of bask in the glow of, you know, of her, you know, of how wonderful this all is, and then we'll come back and nail her on it, you know. So I went out in the woods, and I'm thinking, this is so stupid. Why am I here? Why even bother? And I sat down on the bench, and I said, there's two ways that this can go. Either, you know, I write something down. Either I don't write anything down at all, and I have to leave. And I'll just have to admit that I'm beaten. And for some reason, I just wasn't ready to do that. And or I can do it and, you know, just kind of see what happens. And so I did. I wrote down, you know, something about God. And it was very embarrassing. And, you know, I just thought, oh, of all the shameful, shameful, embarrassing things I've done in my life, this is the worst. I'm sitting out in the woods writing about God. Where is my dignity as a person, you know, in all of this? And I went back and I'm just like, this is bad. And not only was it bad, but it was bad writing on top of it. It made no sense. It was like, God is good, and then there's bad. That's pretty much it. You know, that's what I've got. And I went back and I thought, okay, now there's two ways this can go. Either I'm going to hand this to her and she's going to hate it. And she's going to say, do over, go back and give me 50, you know. And then I'll just have to, like, kill myself right there, you know, because I can't do this again. Or she'll say, oh, this is great, this is wonderful, oh, you know. And she'll, like, hug me, and I'll have to pretend like I had a spiritual experience, and, you know, and it'll just be awful, you know. So I'm like, oh, God, what have I done? And so I go into her office, and I sit down, and I'm still really invested in kind of playing the game because I can't stop that. You know, that's my life. So I'm trying to look like someone who may have had a spiritual experience. So I'm like thoughtful yet desperate. I'm hopeful yet contrite. You know, something between clinging to her by my fingertips and floating away on a cloud, you know, a little element of both. So I sit down and I hand her the paper and she reads it and she kind of, you know, nods a little bit and says, you know, this isn't really very good. And I said, yeah, you know, I know. And she said, but It's enough. It's enough to start. And amazingly, I knew what she meant. It was enough. It was a start. You know, it was, and actually, what she meant was, though I couldn't have articulated this, but somehow in that way I understood this. And she didn't say it, but I understood this. This is not much, but it is the first action you have taken in a long, long time, Karen Nord, which represents something that you had to have some faith in, some belief in, which you did not think was going to work, and which was given to you by someone else, whose direction you didn't have much faith in either, but who you knew had something that you did not, and whose direction you followed precisely as it was given. And that is a huge step for a person like you, and if you can keep doing that, there is a chance that you may recover. And that was what she meant. And many, many years later, I realized that. It was the first thing that I had done that did not reflect my own thinking. That, frankly, I thought was you know, inadequate, stupid, and I could see no connection between it and my problem. None whatsoever. And I did it. I didn't become a model patient, and I didn't become a model patient in the next place they put me after that, and I didn't become a model member of my community afterwards, but I did remember how it felt to do something that I didn't believe in, but that I knew was being presented to me by somebody who had every reason to be believable, you know. And I kept doing those things. Every time I would have that feeling of, this is stupid, you know, this is like borderline crazy. I could come up with better stuff than this. Every time I had that feeling, I would do what I'd been told, because it always turned out to be right. Anyway, so I got out and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and I met my sponsor, and I talked about that yesterday. My sponsor was a woman who had a completely clear and unshakable belief in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she got that through her own experience. And she was the first person when I did my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. I learned that she was an alcoholic, as I was an alcoholic, and that somehow she had become a different person. During my fifth step with her, my first fifth step, I learned more about Esther than she learned about me. Or at least I felt that way. And I understood, not just intellectually, but to the very core of my being, that though maybe all of you were still very different from me, this woman was not. She had occupied the ground that I was standing on. And she was now clearly occupying completely different ground. And what is that? You know? I mean, I knew this, and it gave me the inspiration to keep going. And, you know, I got better. And most of the ways that I got better, I didn't really participate in. You know, my sponsor had me busy doing a lot of things. As soon as I got to 8 and 9, I was in service. I was at a district meeting, I think, my first month that she was my sponsor. Like I said yesterday, I was driving her all over the place. She had somehow convinced me, which I'm sure she thought was hysterical, that she needed my help and that she needed a ride. She was an old woman, frail, and she could not get around by herself, which was complete and utter BS. That was not true at all. She could have probably kicked my butt, you know. But she convinced me. She was an old woman. She had no one. She needed me to take her around. So I'm dumb, and I've got nothing else to do anyway. So, I mean, reluctantly, I used to have these dialogues with myself after work every day when, you know, I started working. I'm going to Esther's again. Why am I going to Esther's again? I've been at Esther's every night for the last month and a half. This is crazy. This is crazy. Nobody else has to do this with their sponsor. I just, you know, I have things to do. I have a life. I have, I know I have something to do. If I were alone for any length of time whatsoever, I would bet I would find I had something to do. And the truth was I didn't. But I would say, what is it? You know, she's been sober for 23 years. Why doesn't she have any friends? What kind of an example is this? Why doesn't she have somebody already to drive her around? You know? What kind of an example is that for a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous? And then I would go to Esther's because I was afraid not to, you know. And I liked driving her around. I would never admit that to anybody. And while we drove around, I drove her all over the Midwest, and we listened to speaker tapes. And we did. We talked about my amends. And we talked about the 10th step. And we read the book. And I met people everywhere, you know, because Esther knew everybody. And all this time, I think I'm helping her, you know, this poor old lady who can't get around on her own. And meanwhile, I've done the steps. I've been to an international convention. I have become, without meaning to at all, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was standing at the international with a year and a half of sobriety in Seattle. In 1990, I was standing in the middle of this huge plaza. There were AA members everywhere, you know, everywhere, as far as the eye could see. It was 2 days in. I was exhausted. You know, I'd been sleeping in a room with 12 people, you know, and no money and working, you know, I got commitments all through. Running from one commitment to the other, stopped for a second in the middle of the plaza, and realized that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, it was just like, God, this is where I live. You know, this is my life. It's not temporary. This is not going to change. I belong here, and I never thought I'd be a member, and I am. I've been one since. You know, and that's a gift you can only give to yourself. You're a member when you say you're a member. And you're not a member until you feel like you are, I don't think. But so, I got better. And a lot of the stuff that I was really just desperate to work on, you know, because I had issues, man. I really did. There was no question. Anybody tell you that? I got some issues. I still do. And, you know, I was angry. And I did have low self-esteem. And I did have financial problems. And I didn't know how to work. And I had terrible luck in relationships. You put a room full of men together, and I will pick the most dangerous person in the room. There is no question. I could tell you, I mean, if I had, I could probably tell you who they are today, you know? But, you know, I had problems. I had no experience. I had never really done anything. I'd had a million jobs, but, you know, I had no life experience at all. The first time that I greeted at a meeting, I thought I was going to die. I mean, I was just like, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? You know, and then somebody would come up and they'd say hi. And I'd be like, hi, you know, and I'd shake their hand and they'd go on, and 5 or 6 people later, I'd be like, hi, okay, see, I got this, hi, you know. And that's how I learned. And I learned how to be a good friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to be a daughter in Alcoholics Anonymous. Esther was as close to a mother as I had had since I'd left my own mother. She taught me everything I know about having a good relationship with my parents today. I learned how to work in AA. I did committee work, you know, and I was terrible at it. I was terrible at it. I was the most unorganized person in the world until I became the most organized person in the world, which was much worse for everybody around me. I would, like, you know, write down, like, notes after notes. I'd call people. I'd leave them, you know, and I'd just drive everybody nuts. I overmanaged everything. But before that, I didn't know how to manage anything at all. And finally, I found the middle. I was power crazy. I was maniacal. I was bad tempered. I was frightened. I was manipulative. I was all of those things. And it all worked out in working through committees. I learned how to be a worker among workers. I learned how to step up and do what I'd been asked to do. And I learned how to step back when it was done and go do the next thing. And let whoever had to do it next do it. I learned all of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only reason that I'm employable today. I'm absolutely convinced. And I did all of this without meaning to. You know, Esther and I didn't set out to work on an issue. We just worked. You know, we just worked on stuff. And I tried, as, you know, has been discussed all through the weekend, to wholeheartedly, you know, give myself over to this process every day. And sometimes it was a heck of a lot more wholehearted than other times, I can tell you that. And sometimes it was moment to moment, and some days it wasn't at all. But I tried. And I got better. And I would turn around and realize that months later. So, you know, today, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's probably the most I can say for myself. I've had so many opportunities. I've been involved with so many things. I've been so many places. I got to work in general service, and I got to work in service in my group, the greatest privilege that anybody ever gets. I got to work at conventions in my city. Like this, I got to be a part of building something and watching it become something other than any of us had expected, you know, more than the sum total of the parts, you know, and I know you guys are experiencing that now right here. It's amazing to think this is more than us. This is more than us. We didn't do this. You know, we did some stuff, yeah, but we didn't do this. I got to work in general service in my area. I got to be a GSR, and then a district committee member, an area chairperson, delegate to the general service office. I got to be one of the chair people at the International Convention in 2000, and every time I turned around and would think about it, I would think, this is not possible. You know, this is not possible for this, not just to get sober, which I had come to terms with, but, you know, how do you end up with this sort of a life and with the kind of people in your life that we have? So, and then I got to go back to my home group and make the coffee and set up the chairs and greet the newcomers and do the things that all of that is really about. Because if that's not happening, the rest of it doesn't make any difference. And it was a privilege. And I've had some bad times, too. You know, I've had a lot of times that I have... I did not get here, and I don't think many of us did, because we are uncomplicated people psychologically, you know. I don't think that that's the case. I was a troubled kid in an untroubled home, you know. I was troubled mentally. And I experienced, I mean, there was a time in my sobriety, I had eight or nine years when I think I finally, as happens to many of us, became strong enough spiritually and had enough support so that, you know, I with no intention, started to find myself troubled. You know, started to find myself feeling like the light was going back out of my life. And it didn't make any sense to me. I didn't understand it. And I thought it was because I wasn't working jobs, you know, or wasn't working them well enough. Because I was sponsoring people, I was involved, I was praying, I was doing everything, and suddenly I was sad all the time, you know, and doubtful. I mean, more than just normally, just doubtful. And I knew I still believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew I didn't want to drink, but ending my life didn't seem like such a bad proposition. And that's a real strange place to find yourself. I mean, maybe in another 15 years I'll know what that was about, but I know what I had to do. You know, I knew that I had to stay involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to tell people what was going on. I had to start talking about the fact that I felt like something was missing. And I did all of those things. And people helped me to find solutions. And I don't feel like that anymore. And I feel different, you know. I think that like I said, many of us are troubled people. And there is an awful lot that life holds for us. And sometimes if you want to walk through all the light places, you got to walk through the dark once in a while too. I was always one, and I still am, for saying no limits, abandon limited objectives. It's right there in the 12 and 12. My objectives will always be limited. God's will never be. If I want everything, then I've got to be willing to give everything. If I want it all, then I have to be willing to give it all. If I want to stop here, I can stop here. And maybe, you know, it'll be okay. But that's not what I want. That's not what I was doing before I got sober. I wasn't stopping any place. And I know that's not what I'm supposed to be doing now. And I think sometimes if you want that, there's just like the big book says, there's a price to be paid. You know, it's got to be the destruction of self. You know, you've got to be willing to give it all. And, you know, I think that's my experience is that's some of what happened to me, and that happens to a lot of people. And I expect there'll be dark times in my future. I'd be real surprised if there weren't. But I know that you guys are always going to be here. I know that there's always going to be a way. I know there's always going to be somebody who's been there, someone who has occupied the ground that I'm standing on and can help me if I am willing to say that I need help. Or to talk about the fact that I'm confused, or to admit that I don't have all the answers. All of those, the rest of it will come to me too. And then I can have unlimited spiritual growth. I can take this as far as I'm supposed to take this. I can be where God wants me to be when I'm supposed to be there. You know, I can keep helping other people. So, if you're new here, stick around. This is really something. You know, it really, I mean, it's something anyway, but it's definitely something here in Reykjavik right now. And there are people here, no matter where you've been, someone has been there. I can guarantee you. Just try to listen and tell them where you are. And they'll be able to help you. If you're not so new here, but you're not feeling that connected, you know, do the same. Start telling people where you're at. Let them be there for you. And if you are here and you're feeling connected and everything's happening for you right now, share that with somebody else. Tell them what happened. Tell them what it was like. Tell them what it's like now. And you know, if we keep doing that, and then, you know, the next group that comes along will have the benefits of this that we've had. And I hope I can come back here sometime. I can't wait to see what it's like here in a few years. You had to be sober in Reykjavik in 2003. You know, it'll be a time to remember, I think. And thanks for having me.